Feminist Internet is a group of artists and designers working to advance internet equalities for women and other marginalized groups through critical practice. The Feminist Internet podcast is commissioned and produced by Somerset House Studios with the support of the University of the Arts London Creative Computing Institute. Over the series, it will explore the theme of recoding spaces, both online and offline, with the aim of diversifying internet spaces metaphorically, physically, and digitally, intercepting homogenous zones and breaking the filter bubble. The podcast aims to not only expose these spaces, but to regenerate them in new and inclusive ways.
The Feminist Internet Podcast. Recoding anger, shaking off the shame of women's rage.
Anger, arguably one of the most overwhelming and all-consuming emotions a person can feel.
The Oxford Dictionary describes anger as a strong feeling of annoyance, displeasure, or hostility.
The Encyclopedia of Psychology says that anger is an emotion characterized by antagonism towards someone or something you feel has deliberately done you wrong.
This is all too clear when we think of the angry women that have filled our screens last year. Some could argue that it was a pivotal time for women freely expressing their anger.
Despite women being told their entire lives to silence their anger, to put it away, out of sight, anger can be a good thing.
Anger is productive. Anger elicits change.
Anger is motivating.
Anger is creative.
Anger is emotional, but it's also physical.
Anger is felt in our bodies and in our societies. Although these displays of anger have been welcomed, there's still a long way to go.
In this episode, we talk about whether as women we are beginning to shake off the shame that comes with being angry, explore different types of anger, but crucially question who in our society has the privilege to be angry and who does not.
Coming up, we're speaking to trans activist and author Charlie Craggs, all-round campaigner against online abuse Shay Akiwowo, LA-based artist Kate Durbin, whose work channels algorithms on the internet. And throughout, we'll be hearing from author Soraya Chamalay, who we think is the authority on women's anger. Her recent book, Rage Becomes Her, The Power of Women's Anger, was published in 2018. It's an exploration into how women's anger plays out in society, relationships, and in our bodies.
I have been writing about issues related to social justice and women's place in the world for a long time, and during and after the 2016 U.S. presidential election, anger was so palpable everywhere. It was pretty starkly clear to me that some people's anger was treated more seriously as a political force than other people's anger. And so I thought it made a lot of sense to look at some of the same issues of social justice and inequality through the filter of how this emotion is socially constructed. So many women grow up in the culture that associates anger with masculinity. To feel anger or to act in anger feels internally transgressive because it's a violation of social norms around being feminine or female or a woman or a girl. That's sort of one level. On another level, women report feeling that what they dread the most if they express anger is mockery, which is literally just not being taken seriously. You feel this very strongly that there's something bothering you. You want to hold your person or community accountable, but what you feel in your heart is that they won't take you seriously, which is the experience of many people. And then third is retaliation and risk. So in the home, for example, women in heterosexual marriages at high rates report that when they're angry, they don't display anger. They display fear or sadness because they don't want a negative response from the men in their lives, their spouses, for example, or maybe their fathers, and that they fear a retaliation. And they're not wrong, because men in those relationships at high levels report thinking that women expressing anger are being selfish. And then in the workplace, of course, there are real risks. I mean, women don't express anger because there are penalties, and study after study after study shows those penalties. People think that they're unlikable, that they're aggressive, that they're mean, that they're bad bosses. Women don't even have to express anger. They just have to be assertive to be cast in those ways. So it's a very narrow path that many women walk when they try and become leaders in the workplace or politically. The same issues hold for politics.
The Feminist Internet Podcast.
I'm Charlie Craggs, and you're listening to the Feminist Internet Podcast.
Hey, Charlie. Thanks
hey.
For talking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
How are you doing?
I'm kind of angry, which is on
good.
Brand. I was saying to you like on the way here, I was like, oh, I'm having such a crap day, which is kind of good because I can definitely tap into things that I probably wouldn't if I was in a good mood. And also, I think my voice sounds nice when I'm angry because I have less energy. So I'm like much more like sexy and slow. So it's kind of working for me.
Okay, that works. Well, this can be therapeutic for
amazing.
All kinds of reasons.
I love it. I am a trans activist and author, and I run a campaign. I guess that's probably what I'm best known for, a campaign called Nail Transphobia. So I travel around the UK with a pop-up nail salon, and I offer the public free manicures for the chance to sit down and have a chat with a trans person. So while I'm doing people's nails, they can kind of ask me whatever. It's my bid to try and humanize the issue, because I felt like that was kind of lacking, is that like when trans people are talked about, it's really sensationalized and really othered, and it's quite alien, and people just don't understand it, and they feel like there's so much to understand.
So in 2018 we saw all kinds of displays of women being angry. What do you think the perception of women's anger is like today, and do you think this has changed or developed now? But also, what about trans women?
I think similar to how female-led activism is perceived, female anger generally is seen as much more like frivolous and much more like less meaningful, and like, oh, like, but have something real to be sad about sort of thing, or like there's a bigger issue. And it's kind of, I feel like it's a similar thing with female-led activism. It's often looked at as like, oh, this is silly, this is just a silly little thing, and like it's just like, no, like it just makes me so angry, because I get that a lot of what I do. I think because I use such like a femme activity like painting nails, I get dismissed as like, oh, this isn't real activism, like there's like, do you need something new to be angry about, a new way of doing it? And it's like, I posted yesterday that I did I posted his tweet, but I did Richard Branson's nails. Like I'm like able to like use what I'm doing like to like disrupt those environments and like speak to like this one of the most powerful men in the world and make sure that he's on the side, like things like, and it's like, oh wow, so like painting nails is stupid, right? Yeah, even though I've just done his nails, there's a million other things I've done, but that's just an example. And it just really annoys me how female anger and female activism is looked at like less than.
And what was it like doing his nails?
He had disgusting nails. You can sue me, sorry Richard, babe. I said it to him, I was like, babes, why are your nails so bad? I was like, you got money, I'll come live in your house, I can do your nails whenever you want. I used to do a lot of like TV stuff talking about trans stuff. Like I was pitched against this man once, and I was like, why should I have to be not angry and polite? Like it's like you're attacking me, it's not an equal debate, it's you bullying me, you're attacking me, and it's like I should be allowed to be angry. And I know that if I was, like the public would be like, oh, look at this angry trans woman, like just, you can't even listen to her, like we're not allowed to be angry. Like a man can like shout and like get like very aggressive with the anger, like aggressively angry, and we're told like no. Like even my own community, I know that like they would judge me, they'd be like, oh, you represented us really badly. And it's like, no, like I personally don't agree with that, and that's why I stopped doing it, because I'm all for being angry. If you're gonna like deny my womanhood, if you're gonna reject my human rights, I'm sure as hell gonna be angry about it. Like if a trans person says something that's a bit like provocative, Piers Morgan can shout all he wants, but he's not looked at like he's some crazy man, he's just looked at like a voice of reason, and it's like it's a necessary anger, I guess.
We know that the life expectancy of trans people is horrifically low. Do you ever feel like personally, when you're in public, if you've had to showcase some of your anger, have you ever felt like that could be dangerous for you?
Absolutely. So I'm quite lucky now, but it's only because I've paid for my luck, in that like I got a lot of surgery on my face about a year ago to pass. Passing means basically kind of like a blending in as cis, like so you don't stand out, because pre-facial surgery I looked very trans, like I'm not going to go into it, but basically yeah, I just would get abuse, like you don't, like anyone who's not trans doesn't understand how much abuse a trans person gets, because you're just like there for people to laugh at and people to be rude about. And so like often it was often verbal, the few times it was physical, but the few times I stood up for myself and got angry, or not even angry, well I guess angry, I was angry inside, but I didn't shout back at them, but I would just, even if I just give them a dirty look back, they would like attack me then, or assault me, whatever you want to call it, because I had the audacity to stand up for myself. Like, they think, people literally think they can call you a tranny or say, aha, that's a man, and that's fair game. And to be fair, it's because the media's taught them that. Like, things like Maury, Jerry Springer have taught people, when you see a trans person, you can say, that's a man. Like, or that it's like a game, like, spot the tranny. Like, so people think they have a right to it, and they're shocked. Like, you should see the shock on their faces if I'd ever say anything back, ever look at them funny. They'd be like, what the fuck did you say? And it's like, are you serious? Like, literally all I said is, excuse me. And you're acting like I've insulted you. And it's like, so I learned very early on, like, about, like, my anger. Like, and so I learned just to, like, you just don't say anything. And that's just the way it is. And that fucking sucks. Especially for me, because I'm a very, like, feisty person. Like, I like to stand up for myself. I think I have a right to stand up for myself. I'm not scared to stand up for myself even. Like, I was bullied from a very, very young age, and I've always stood up for myself, but it was different pre-transition. Now it's just like, no, I just can't. Because, like, even if you do raise your voice and say, or not raise your voice, I mean literally but metaphorically, and say something when someone's done something wrong to you or is doing something wrong, you don't feel like anyone's gonna have your back around you. And it's happened to me so many times. And then your anger, your speaking up about something is deemed as, like, nonsensical. Like, people look at you like, oh, why is this, like, or they almost feel like you deserve it. Sometimes it's nuanced and there's different layers to it. But, like, if I would be, like, argue back with someone, say on the tube, like, the amount of times I had arguments on the tube and, like, no one gets involved, or you almost feel like they think that they're on the other person's side, or even just the fact that they're not on your side is an insult, really, because it's like, I'm in the right, this person has been you see people, like, rolling their eyes, or, like, it's not an argument, it's not equal because this person is attacking me. Like, so I just learned very early on, like, don't bother, like, just take yourself out of the situation if you can. There's so few of us in the world, and the fact of the matter is that, like, I think the latest statistic is, like, every 29 hours a trans person is reported murdered. And that's, like, not even, because not all countries give their stats, but also a lot of places will log trans murders as just, like, a man, because they see us as male, or they'll call it, like, a gay man in a dress or whatever. So it's not even logged as a trans murder. So the number's probably much higher, and it's much, much higher, disproportionate for trans women of colour. It's like, I've got a 1 in 12 chance of being murdered in my life, and a trans woman of colour has a 1 in 8. It's mad. And a trans woman of colour, like, their life expectancy is, like, 35, I think. It's madness. Madness.
What advice or tactic would you give people on being an angry feminist, and how to free their anger more productively? Yeah. Particularly in a feminine way.
Doing something productive. That's what I'd focus on, is starting Nail Transphobia was my way of almost processing the abuse, because I had no other way of processing it. My life was so, so bad, and it couldn't have got any worse, really, in that sense. And I was like, I need to do something to, like, turn this negative into a positive, because I think it's the only way to get through bad things sometimes, is to take the negative and try and do something positive from it. Otherwise, it's just a negative. So I was like, let me do something positive. And I have, like, I've set up Nail Transphobia, I've set up my nail brand, Nail It, I've got my book To My Trans Sisters. So I'm doing all these things. It's almost like, I was going to say fixed, but that's a lie, because I'm still very much affected and traumatized by things I went through in my early transition. But it has helped me to, like, process what I went through. So I would say, just focus on doing something. And you don't have to start your own project if you've not got the energy or the resources. You can lend your time to someone else's project, or there's so many things you can get involved in online. But I think it's just about doing something to process that, otherwise it stays with you, and it makes you jaded and bitter and sick. It does. I was sick. I was like, I'm not going to go into it, but I was really, really, my body, like really bad, I will go into boils, like acne, things like that, like really, really bad. Like, my skin got so bad, I was losing hair, I was like, just like everything. Yeah, you just can get really ill from things. Like, you just internalize it and you just keep it, and you do something to let it out and put some goodness into the world, and then do it now. Get off this podcast and do it now.
I am a nasty woman.
We are unstoppable. Another one is possible.
The Feminist Internet Podcast.
Anger encompasses such a broad spectrum of feelings and then ultimately behaviors. And so the way I tried to think about anger was not in the stereotypical sense that people often envision, which is kind of a rageful explosion that's destructive and negative, but as a feeling that warns us. It's a signal emotion, right? It's a feeling that is telling us something about the experiences we're having. And it is the emotion that conveys, as Audre Lorde said, all this information and knowledge, and we should be paying attention to it, and instead of ignoring it or losing our own sense of experiencing it. And so the way I tried to think about anger was in that framework. What is the information that this emotion is conveying? And, you know, everybody experiences anger differently. Some people physically experience it in their bodies much more strongly. Some people ruminate and think about it. Some people ignore it entirely. And some people, never really learn to control its most destructive forces. But in any of those instances, the fact remains that the emotion conveys information.
Shea Kiwowo is the founder and executive director of Glitch, a growing not-for-profit organization that aims through campaigning and training to end online abuse.
I always refer to Glitch as an accident. Oops, baby. I was elected as a counselor at the age of 23, making me the first black female counselor to be elected in my local area. And so that came with a lot of media attention, which was good because the platform that I was elected on was around representation of young women, black women, young people, and the issues that affected us, particularly around youth violence and access to democracy. And I guess with all of that came media attention, as well as policymakers wanting to know actually, like, what can we do? And part of that was being invited to the European Parliament to talk about how to get more young people interested in the European agenda. This was in 2016, before Brexit, so probably didn't do a good job given the state that we're in right now. But I was there, and this was also during the time of the Syrian refugee crisis. I remember being in the hemicycle and thinking, rah, like, I'm like this black girl, Nigerian, from East London, single parent family, like here talking, like it was a big deal. So it was really an emotional point for me. But at the same time, there was this big emergency discussion around the Syrian refugee crisis. And there was a young boy on the panel talking about his experience. I got goosebumps and I was like, we have to do something. Like, what, you know, like, this is wrong. Really hearing from her first-hand experience. And he was talking about how he's not seen his mum and his sister since he's moved over. And he's putting forward a case of how we as Europeans could help the effort. And all of a sudden there was this like loud booing sound, like negative, like it was like a storm that came in the hemicycle. And it was the French National that were there. It was about 100 of them booing this guy off stage. And cutting a long story short, being the girl from the ends, I guess, I just wanted to say something, and I did. And I didn't know what I was going to say. Like, I just knew I had to stand up and be an advocate for him the way I've been an advocate for other people in my community. And I just really don't like bullies. And so I said something. The European Parliament filmed it, didn't know. And then they put it up online a couple months later and it went viral, which was cool because the response to it was great, but I wasn't expecting it. Loads and loads of people were sharing it and it was really positive, like, yes, black girl magic. And you know, it was really nice, and even to spark a conversation. And there were some people that disagreed with what I said, but said, like, well done for you for calling it out, which was great. But then someone or people decided to put it on a neo-Nazi website, and I was in the gym. I remember, like, it was the 1st of Feb, so it's like it was this time 2 years ago. I can't remember, 3 years ago. And I was in the gym and it was like Rihanna Work 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 was on, and my Spotify kept cutting out, and I was like, why is my Spotify cutting out? I paid my £10 a month, it should be unlimited playlists, what's going on? I pause the treadmill, I pick up my phone to see what's all these interruptions. And it was this storm of abuse, like the N-word and variations of it, death threats, rape threats, stuff to do with my body parts, my private parts as well, and on YouTube and Twitter. And I was like, what is going on? Like, what's happened? And there, basically, like, my life stopped for like 3 weeks. And I look back now and I probably wasn't at my healthiest as well, if I think about it, like mentally. I had to go, I called a contact at the police station, and they said to me, you need to go to the police and make a statement. And like, I was like, oh my gosh, how am I going to tell my Nigerian mother that I have to go to the police, make a statement? And it wasn't even that. So that was frightening, and the abuse was like, what's going on? What was frustrating and where Glitch came about was when I reported the abuse, the N-word, the obvious violations to their platforms, they didn't respond. Like, it was like air, ignored me. And I felt so disrespected. And I was asking myself, like, why are you getting so upset about this? Like, and it was because I had used the platform and engaged on these platforms the way we're meant to connect with people and to learn and to laugh at memes and GIFs and to create a positive platform to try and be an inspiration to your community. And when my rights were being violated, this platform was nowhere to be seen, but they could benefit from me using the hashtags and interacting with the platform. And so that really angered me, and it meant that I had to do a lot of campaigning around it and media and stuff. And so I was on ITV London, BBC Radio, talking about, like, social media companies have let me, and not just me, other women down, and it's not safe. And there's a glitch that is stopping the internet from working to its fullest potential. There's a glitch that's stopping social media from being this amazing tool that could continue to be life-changing for a lot of people. And so that's where the movement started, and lots of people were interested in telling me their story and asking me, how do you document abuse, and can you come into our schools and talk to our young people? And so that birthed Glitch, the organisation, where we're all about ending online abuse. And we know that it disproportionately affects women and young people. And so that's who we work with and what we're about. And we go into schools and talk about digital citizenship and understanding that we have rights to be online, for sure, but that means we also have a responsibility. And what does that look like? And us actually taking the internet back and social media back and claiming it to be our community and saying, actually, no, we're not the minority here. Those that are filling it with hate are the minority, and we're going to self-police our online community the same way we would do if it was your local area, local council, whatever. And our digital resilience workshop is about countering what we're seeing, a trend we're seeing of young women and women more generally. Actually, old women tell me this too, that they don't want to be online. They censor themselves, and actually stats support that. So Amnesty's toxic Twitter report, which I'm a part of, their research showed that 3/4 of those women surveyed were censoring themselves in some way. And so digital resilience is about combating that. How can we give women the skills and the knowledge to feel that they can make informed decisions online about their privacy settings, about what they're sharing, how to report it, and actually how to access justice? What's recently angered me about that is actually access to justice is not at the moment for everybody. If we know that women are disproportionately affected by online abuse, whether that's the UN stat that says women are 27 times more likely to be abused globally, or Amnesty stats about 22% of women in the UK. And then we know that women of colour are disproportionately affected. And the Amnesty's report last year showed that black women were 84% more likely than white women to receive abuse. If we know all of that, women also are less likely to have the cultural capital, the networks and the relationships with the institutions that they would need to protect them and help them, safeguard their rights. Your white male privileged guy would have a better rapport with police, would have, and also being very careful about class here, I'm saying privilege because I know there are white working class communities that don't have the best relationship with the police. So I totally understand that intersectional point there. But I'm talking about white privileged men who were able to have contacts with the police, have contacts within law firms, be able to fundraise the money, whatever it would take to fight a case. Women are less likely to have that, and women of colour less likely to have that, and black women are less likely to have that, like, as we keep going down the kind of intersectional channel, if you like. And so if you're a black woman that's been defamed online, you've been called names, you've been attacked or harassed, and people are spreading these lies about you, where do you go to get access to justice? Who believes you? If you are a woman of colour, you're most likely to be in areas that don't have a lot of resources. So police stations are being cut, and there's been cuts to legal aid budget. So if you rock up to your local police station and say, hey, someone's defaming online, how trained are those police officers to be able to take that seriously as well? So there's just such a difference in how women and women of intersecting multiple intersecting identities can access justice and get some kind of, I can't say any other way, how can women get justice for something that's happened to them online? And as we're moving debate and as we're moving democracy and conversations online, women are being forced out. And then when women are being attacked, they've got no way of getting any justice.
In 2018, there was loads of stuff that came out about how, you know, there were several different types of public displays of anger by women. Do you think the perception of women's anger has changed? Do you think it's developed? Do you think it's different now as opposed to last year?
I think there's two things I want to say. There's one around who is able to be angry and fully angry as well, not a kind of censored version of that. And then also women overall being able to acknowledge their anger. I remember growing up being labelled angry, looking back. And actually it's reading books like Soraya's book and Stay in Your Lane, where I was like, oh, that's not normal. That's not what people are meant to say to me. And I've actually, when I look back, of course I'm going to be angry because institutional racism is real. So every day at school something was happening and getting and the way I was being treated, obviously there was an emotional reaction or response to me happening within me. And so I was always labeled as like quite negative and complaining and bossy and never happy. And I was then told it wasn't attractive, and that's why, you know, I don't have a boyfriend and stuff like that. And I remember for a couple of years suppressing quite my anger to stuff, my awareness to things that were not fair, just to try and fit in. And then after that, I was like, I can't be bothered anymore. I'm going to just be who I am. And actually social media allowed me to be who I am and adopt anger in an empowering way, in a passionate way, and in a way that provides safety as well, in a way that provides protection and being able to call things out to make it safer for the next generation or another woman. I don't think I want feminism to stay angry. I don't want us to stay in the point of anger. It's not always healthy. It's not healthy to stay in one emotion, is it? So it's not healthy. And also it means that we can easily turn on each other. And I think that's what we're starting to see, like lots of divisions unraveling within the feminist movement, because we're like, I'm paraphrasing Audre Lorde's quote, something about the press will use the oppressor's tactics. And I feel like if we stay in this angry mode, we will end up turning on each other and looking for perfection and cancelling each other out. And it's just not healthy. Like, it's jarring and it's so tiring being angry. So that's just my kind of caution to the feminist movement. What are we going to do so that we channel our anger into change? Well, I'm really glad that people are talking, using their testimonies for Me Too and R. Kelly and all of that to bring about change. So let's just see more of that. And then the other side of anger, as a Black woman, I'm so conscious that I cannot be fully angry about things. There's so many things that I've wanted to say on social media. Or there's so many things I've wanted to say to people, or respond to an email, and I know that I can't because I don't have the privilege to be angry. I know that my response to what happened to me was palatable to communities, and that's why I was able to galvanize their support. I was and still am within my rights to cuss those trolls that tried to silence me and threaten me. Well, they didn't try, they did. I am within my rights to react however I want. But I don't think if I reacted like that, I would have got the support that I did. I have noticed that when I've responded to trolls since having more of a platform for this, people have DM'd me saying, I don't think you should respond like that. I don't think you should react like that. And I will respond however I want. Sometimes I'll respond to trolls dissing them in Yoruba, my mother's language, and they spend time trying to translate what I've said, and then they try and come back to me in Yoruba, and I'm like, you've just wasted an hour of your life. And so, yeah, I think it's paralyzing as a Black woman, always having to gauge your reaction, how someone receives you, which is a privilege that unfortunately white women do have.
Anger in its own right as an emotion on its own is about saying, I feel like this is wrong and you've done me wrong. But this becomes even more clear when we look online, you know, especially with Diane Abbott, the horrific statistic that of the 25,000 angry messages targeted at female MPs last year, most of them went to just Diane Abbott alone.
And do you know what's really frightening about that? Diane Abbott got so much abuse that she was skewing the results for when they were categorising women and Labour. And that's just on one platform. That's not taking account Facebook. That's not taking into account the emails and probably hoax calls that she gets too. I have a lot of admiration for Diane Abbott. I talked about her when we presented at the UN and referenced her, and also a black female MEP, Cecilia Kienge, in Italy, because they go through quite similar experiences. But we also have to be careful not to idolise Diane Abbott. Like, she is an example of the experience that black women face, but she's not the only black woman facing that. So we have to be careful to not commodify Serena Williams and Diane Abbott, and not try and treat black women as this kind of homogeneous group as well. Because actually, if you start unpicking it, black women from working class communities would receive different levels of abuse, black trans women as well. So I just think it's really great that Amnesty have been intersectional in their reporting, and that everyone knows that stat. It's so good. And it's good that finally that Diane Abbott is getting the support or the push on social media to support, like the Abbott appreciation tweets and stuff is great. We have to remember there are, what about the other black women that are online that don't get the profile as like Diane Abbott, that are suffering as well?
If he has to choose one thing, and this could be either offline or online, what tactic or piece of advice would you give someone on being an angry feminist?
Reflection is so important, because that's how we also learn to grow. I'm a big believer in Caroline Dweck's theory, growth mindset. And actually, I think some of our activism needs to be developed on that, because we need to forgive people who are on a journey of understanding how to just be better allies and better people, right? And to come out of the kind of structural oppression that we've all grown up under. And I think reflection allows you to do that. Reflection allows you to be like, to say to yourself, like, could I be better person, better ally, better active bystander? And also, could my activism be more inclusive? Could my work be more inclusive? Some people are looking for the next thing to be angry about, so they can tweet about it and can go viral. And so I would just want to say, reflect and check yourself. And are you the best person to talk about this issue? Do you have the range to talk about this issue?
The Feminist Internet Podcast.
There's an inherent contradiction in people's minds with femininity and power and anger and leadership. That's how implicit biases work. Men report associating anger with power, and women report overwhelmingly associating anger with powerlessness. And I think that's because that's how most women experience it. They don't, you know, power accrues to men when they use their anger, even if it's inflected with racism. You know, a black man in the United States, his anger is considered, you know, it's linked to criminality. But even in criminality, there's a certain power to the threat implied in the racist imagination, right? But for women, it's always the case that the biggest risk is that they grow less influential if they express anger. I think we see the dangers of a black man expressing anger every day in the United States, right? Even if it's justifiable anger, the risk of being arrested or shot for simply expressing indignation or self-defense is high, you know? And it leads to sort of a very definite hypervigilance. For women, that's also true, because in addition to maybe being incarcerated as an adult woman or being penalized as a young girl in school, there's always the threat of sexual violence. And so for black women and women of color, the stereotypes around anger that represent them as threatening become a lever of oppression and real danger. So we see that young black girls in schools in the United States are at least 5 times more likely to be suspended or disciplined. You know, that angry black woman stereotype that we so often see and hear about in our media starts early for young girls. And the effects of that, I think, never, you know, they never really fade. We see that in media coverage, for example, of Serena Williams, right? We see it in the way that Serena Williams is depicted in media and in photography and in illustrations all the time. You know, there's the angry black woman stereotype, but there are also other stereotypes. So for women of Hispanic or Mediterranean descent, there's this quality of sexualization, this sort of hot, fiery imagery. There's this kind of wink, wink, isn't she cute? If you happen to be a woman of Asian descent, it's not anger that the stereotype is dominated by, but the ultra feminine quality of sadness. So, you know, online there's this sort of, and in media in general, there's a trope of the sad Asian girl who's silent and passive and mute. Indeed, is so passive that you never see the anger at all, or even the hint of anger. And at least in the United States, and you know, for a white woman to be angry, she just risks being cast as crazy. Like, she's just, you know, insane. And there's an endless list of young women celebrities and performers who seem to have to go through this rite of passage of being considered crazy women when they start to express their anger.
Up with the sisters, down with misogyny. Up with the sisters, down with misogyny. Like a girl, fight like a girl.
Do you ever feel like you're raging into a social media echo chamber? Kate Durbin, Los Angeles-based artist, writer and filmmaker, created Unfriend Me Now, a short film examining the role of how Facebook's algorithm has spurred increasing political polarization, and how that polarization, and namely rage, has been co-opted by corporate interests.
My name is Kate Durbin. I'm a US-based artist, writer, and filmmaker. A lot of my work has to deal with popular culture and digital media. And some of it, like the piece we're going to talk about today, has to do with the way kind of our lives and our political situation has been changed by social media and the advent of the internet. The idea came about very personally. In the months leading up to the 2016 presidential election of Donald Trump here in the US, I was kind of witnessing this phenomenon unfolding online that was very disturbing and upsetting to watch, which was just this sort of increased argumentation and extreme rhetoric from people just sort of fighting with each other on Facebook. And then that happened, of course, after the election, and still sort of lingered into the present day. So I, you know, saw people, friends and family, people that I knew personally speaking this way. And so it was something that I had never witnessed on Facebook before. And it seemed troubling to me because people weren't really having debates with each other or talking with each other, but they were just sort of screaming into the void. It just got more and more intense. So I created a character called Facebook Clown. And Facebook Clown, when I created him, I was thinking about kind of the historical significance of the clown as like a trickster figure, a jester who can speak kind of uncomfortable truths to those who are in power, and also just sort of more generally truths that maybe the population wouldn't normally be comfortable looking at, but the clown figure can kind of embody them in a both satirical and serious way at the same time. And so Facebook Clown performs within the white box of the Facebook timeline in the video different real posts from people on the right and the left of the political spectrum here in the US. So I actually collected real posts from a public search in Facebook. I didn't use anyone I know's posts. They're all from a public search for the words Unfriend Me Now and Trump. And so Facebook Clown performs their posts in an embodied way. So that was one thing that was important to me, that the clown would be performing kind of a physical humor and using, you know, their voice as opposed to just seeing the text in the box. So it goes back and forth between Republicans and liberals, which are, you know, really the only political parties in power that we have here in the US. It's part of our broken system that we only have two. And then at the end of the video, after going back and forth between these two sort of different sets, the video transitions to what I call the hellscape. And then it's just clowns kind of screaming, "Unfriend me now," into the void.
Unfriend me now.
And the video zooms out and you get to see a bigger and bigger hellscape. And towards the end, some of the clowns are getting tired. Some of them are burning on fire. I was really inspired by William Blake's Dante's Inferno there. The video really ends on that note. So I was thinking there about like being trapped forever in Facebook as if that was our only reality and how that would really affect how we felt and how we communicated with other people. My partner says that sometimes. He'll be like, "Oh, you just said that Facebook clown just came out of your mouth." And I'm like, "Well, it is me performing Facebook clown, so he is in me." I do feel like with any work of art, I'm very open to them taking away whatever they get from it. But what people have told me that they feel is a number of things. One, they feel kind of like it's like an exorcism of a traumatic experience that they've had on Facebook. And I think if I were to have said that a few years ago, people would have just laughed at the thought of like combining trauma with Facebook. But a lot of people here in the US, especially those of us on the left of the political spectrum, were traumatized and continue to feel traumatized by this administration. You know, the fact that they're so hell-bent on taking away, you know, women's rights, and they're, you know, racist and xenophobic and all these sorts of things. That sort of relentless arguing on Facebook did have an effect on a lot of us, and a lot of people quit Facebook during that time because it just wasn't a place that made them feel any better about anything. They just felt worse. So people have felt like, "Oh, I feel exorcised," or that the demons have been exorcised and I feel better about everything. Other people are like re-traumatized by it. And a lot of people find it funny. So they laugh at, you know, the humor of Facebook clown. And a curator from the Broad Museum here in LA saw it and she said she really appreciated that it managed to capture the humanity of people on Facebook, even while being funny and, you know, kind of the experience of being a human being on Facebook, which is something we sort of lose, I think, with the interface and with all of the things we lose when we use social media platforms where we're not, you know, immediately kind of physically present with somebody. You know, the platform is built for attention and clicks and to keep us engaged. And so the more intense your post is emotionally and the more anger you express, or actually I would call it rage more than anger, then the more likely you are to get that attention. And so it really kind of rewards that affect. You know, that's a big part of the piece too, is like thinking about, well, if we were to like go around every day in our daily lives just screaming like that, what would that look like? It would be very terrible and quite silly at the same time. I don't think that there's always like a cut and dry border between anger and rage, but I do see rage as kind of co-opted anger. You know, as human beings, we like to think that we just sort of have our own thoughts and our own feelings. And, you know, especially here in the US with such a like individualist culture, people really like to think of themselves as individuals who are like free thinking and free feeling. But the internet, because we're all on it and staring at the same things all of the time and responding to the same things, really has been an interesting kind of experiment in social contagion. So, you know, I really see rage as like, the anger has been co-opted by Facebook, by the news media, by these other platforms that want to keep us angry so that we will keep reacting to the latest thing that will make us angry and stay engaged with the platform. We need our anger. It helps us to make change, especially political change. But rage on the internet often kind of serves in the opposite direction to just keep us, you know, raging out against the machine, so to speak, endlessly feeding our rage into the void in a kind of useless way, really, and in a way that tires us out and makes us feel like real change is not possible. The thing that really kind of freaked me out about Facebook during this process was just thinking about the invisibility of the algorithm and all of these mechanisms that were at play. You know, people didn't even realize when they were screaming into the void that their engagement on Facebook was creating an echo chamber so that the only people they were screaming at were the people that they agreed with, you know, because they're unfriending everyone they disagree with and they're clicking only on the people that they do agree with. And so they're not even seeing the people that they're supposedly shouting against and supposedly changing their minds. More awareness of this whole ball of wax would be useful for people. And it's interesting. We live in this moment where, you know, rage is a very prominent emotion on the internet, and it was not always so.
I always think when people say, "You sound so angry," it's very clear that they have no interest at all in why. They don't say, why are you upset or what is making you angry? Their discomfort comes from the fact that I sound angry. And in some cases, I don't sound angry at all. I'm literally just describing a situation that makes them uncomfortable. And not even just the sound of anger. I would argue that the sound of women claiming the power to testify honestly and expect accountability is what's bothersome. There's a real irony in the way women are isolated often by anger. Anger can be very isolating if you don't talk about it or make meaning from it or join communities because of it, right? But it is, in fact, a really social emotion because it usually means that the people around you need to do something. And that might be a parent or a spouse or a coworker or, you know, a politician. But it is, in fact, an emotion that engenders connection, not isolation, if it is properly dealt with. So the advice I would give really is to label the way you're feeling accurately. Don't minimize it. You know, don't say I'm irritated, I'm stressed, I'm tired. But to use the accurate description, if you're angry, say I'm angry, and then decide how you're going to use that information. And as a feminist, I can honestly say that the most productive, creative, happy activism that I've participated in has resulted from doing that. It's resulted from feeling angry or indignant about a problem and then finding other people who feel the same way and then making the change that we would like to see. And that's what I would recommend doing.
So that was some pretty interesting summaries of anger, of angry bodies, of angry identities, of danger with anger as well as anger online.
Maybe it'd be a good idea to kind of like summarize what we've learned and try and be affirmational and like going forward, how do we learn to be angry and be unapologetic and mobilize this anger into something that can be really positive.
Yeah, I think for me, the thing that's kind of hit me the hardest is this idea that, you know, in 2018, it was, of course, amazing that there were so many wicked displays of anger, of protests, of, you know, women, but it anger doesn't seem to be our only weapon. You know, there's so many different ways of using anger, and I think as long as we're moving towards a place where we shake off the shame of it, that doesn't necessarily mean that anger is the only emotion that can utilize change. I think it's definitely an important one, but this idea that, you know, individual anger has been suppressed for so long, but really anger in communities, in groups, at protests, is so much more powerful.
Anger doesn't have to be this lonely emotion. It's something that can bring us all together. I think self-care is really important when thinking about being angry and picking your battles and looking after yourself, especially for some people, educating and being angry
And speaking your mind can be really exhausting and really emotionally labor intensive. It's knowing that it's okay sometimes to not have to educate people all the time, and taking that time for yourself to look after yourself, and knowing that you don't always have to put your anger to action, you know?
Yeah, definitely. But also not suppressing it, because it can become a sickness. But there are different kind of ways and tactics to do that. You know, if a man interrupts you in a meeting at work, just don't stop talking. The idea that, you know, for me especially, when I'm in a situation where I feel like I'm at my boiling point and I know that the people around me aren't perceiving my anger well, and they say things like, calm down, which is the worst thing you could say to an angry person.
Calm down. Calm down.
You know, saying, I'll say things like, you need to listen to me and my feelings are valid. And instead of being frightened that this conversation is going to be palatable, maybe hear what I'm trying to say, because I feel like I've been done wrong in X, Y, and Z. And I think as long as people can do that for themselves, but also do that for other people. So if someone in your presence is getting angry, particularly a woman of several different kinds of intersectional identities, just listen.
Supporting the people around you. So if you notice a friend of yours or being angry, it's like being an active bystander. And if you see someone's visibly angry and maybe trying to suppress it, you know, ask them, are you all right? Or validate them within the group and say, and I can understand why this person's angry, and I think we should listen to them.
If you're a bystander and you're seeing something play out, not just anger, but if you are silent and aren't an active participant in trying to stop certain kinds of abuse and assault happen, you are essentially, your silence is the violence around that too.
To quote Audre Lorde, what does it mean when the tools of a racist patriarchy are used to examine the fruits of the same patriarchy? The master's tools may allow us to temporarily beat him at his own game, but they will never enable us to bring about genuine change.
It's clear from the people that we've interviewed, anger is not only powerful and productive in individual cases, but also in groups, communities, societies, and protests. Anger will never be women's most powerful weapon, but perhaps it's a good place to start.
Some